Good morning. Welcome to the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. I'm Madeline Reynolds, the associate producer of the Roundtable on WAMC. Each weekday morning, the Roundtable's Joe Donahue is joined by various experts, journalists, educators, and commentators to discuss current events. On Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review, we feature selections from this week's shows. This week's selections are from Locked Box panels and a Live at the Linda panel. On Wednesday, September 18th, a Locked Box panel focused on immigration, and Joe was joined by Albany Law School professor Sarah Rogerson, partner with the Albany law firm of Whiteman, Osterman & Hannah, Sienna Freeman Tolbert, Siena College professor of comparative politics Vera Icarius Kelly, dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Robert Griffin, and Alex Norosta is the vice president for economic and social policy studies at the Cato Institute.
And especially since you put together this piece about myths about immigration, and I just curious as to your thoughts on why, well, especially politically, but not exclusively politically, but why this is such a difficult issue for us to discuss and to get our hands around.
So I think the main reason why is because of the chaos along the border and the perception of chaos on the border. And we see this in multiple different issues. If there is chaos in your neighborhood, let's say having to do with drugs, or if there's chaos in the labor market having to do with economic turmoil, or chaos along the border with immigration, people usually turn against even the legal versions of those activities because people don't like chaos. And so when we see these images along the border, or even when there's not chaos, people think there is along the border, it makes having a conversation about legalization or liberalization or what to do to try to get the border under control and to liberalize immigration very, very difficult. And it's not unique to immigration, but I think that's the best modern example of that sort of, I call it chaos theory.
When you look at chaos theory, and we asked this question, we were talking about it at the beginning of the show, and obviously using the most recent example of what's happening in Springfield, Ohio, why does it work? Why does that chaos work in a community like that and have resonance across the country?
I think people just fundamentally dislike chaos. They dislike disorder. They want things to be understood. They want them to be rational. Nobody wants to walk outside of their house in the morning to get the newspaper. I guess nobody does that anymore. But, you know, they get the newspaper out in the morning and, you know, every day see something totally different, crazy and unexpected happening in their front yard, right? People just don't like that. So when you have a situation like in, you know, Springfield, where people are making a lot of allegations about what's going on, it seems chaotic. You know, you see, if you hear a story about an individual eating pets, even before you find out it's false, or you find out it's false, you're just going to be sort of repulsed by that. It's going to be chaotic. It's going to be a very large political mess. And that, I think, is what we're seeing in microcosm in Springfield. It's what we're seeing nationally. To be sure, there are other reasons, but if the border were under control, if there were 5,000 people a month coming in and being apprehended instead of 50 to 100,000, I think this issue would not be a big deal. We wouldn't be talking about it right now.
You have written a piece called Most Common Arguments Against Immigration and Why They're Wrong. And while it is very, some 15 common myths about immigration, and while we can't address all 15, I'm interested in just you giving us a synopsis of how these myths come about and what many of the myths have in common.
Sure. So I think the one myth I want to start with is the idea that it's very easy to immigrate to the United States legally. The common myth, and it's not true anymore. The U.S. has a very restrictive and difficult immigration system. Most other rich countries actually let in more immigrants as a percentage of their population than the U.S. does. And I think the reason why this myth persists is because the U.S. used to be very open to immigration. And almost all of our ancestors came during the time when the U.S. was open, during Ellis Island and before. So I think that's why that myth persists today. And it impacts the current debate, because people look at illegal immigration and they think, well, what do they have to hide? Why don't they just go get a green card? It's really easy to wait in line, just like my ancestors did. But that's not the way it is. So that's why that is so important in today's debate. If I could flip a switch and expose Americans to this information about, you know, any information about immigration, I would expose them to just the legal realities of the current immigration system and how impossible it is for the majority of people who want to come here to do so legally.
Well, and that's how you get the border under control, is to fix the freaking policies that are incentivizing people to come through irregularly. That's how you fix the border.
I think that's exactly right. I think the right analogy is the prohibition. You know, they banned alcohol in the early 20th century, prohibition. It caused a huge black market, enormous chaos, crime. And, you know, that crime and chaos didn't go away because the government enforced the law perfectly. It went away when the government gave up, changed the law, made alcohol legal again. And I think that's what we need to do, is we need to make immigration boring again. We need to make it so that people can come in legally. They can come in fairly easily. They can work. They can live. They can pay taxes. They can contribute. And it's a lot easier. And then if you do that, nobody wants to sneak through the desert anymore to come in or hire a smuggler. And the handful of people who do, you can actually focus Border Patrol on those individuals because, well, in that situation, they probably do have something to hide.
And isn't that one of the strange situations with Springfield, is that it's actually the population we're talking about is here legally. It's, you know, what DeWine and the officials in Ohio are saying is that this is a legal community. They're here legally. So this is even more bizarre that J.D. Vance and Trump are tripling down on this.
Correct. All the majority of the Haitians have temporary protected status, and they all have legal authorization to work here in the U.S.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And it's this sort of I don't know what to call it, like patriotic correctness or political correctness, but it's very hard in the U.S. to complain about immigration by itself, right? We usually have these discussions about illegal immigrants, but there is a contingent, a portion of the Republican Party that wants to reduce legal immigration. And I think this is partly a response to that. When people don't like a legal immigrant community in the U.S., they almost feel like they have to describe them as being illegal. It's almost like the word illegal has lost its real meaning and has become just a euphemism for, I don't like this group.
Mm-hmm. Never mind the fact that undocumented immigrant New Yorkers contribute $3 billion in taxes. That means the illegal, quote unquote, illegal immigrants in New York are contributing $3 billion in taxes. And if folks were given work authorization, you could add another billion to that number in terms of the tax base. That's from the New York Immigration Coalition.
Yeah, and that was what I was going to say, just to piggyback on what Sarah and Alex were saying, is that that's the number one question that I get when an individual comes to my office the first time, is how can I get a work permit? How can I work? And if we were able to expand the immigration policies and the laws bringing people in here and make it less complicated, because it's terribly complicated, then maybe that would help. That would definitely help at the southern border. If we turn some of those CBP-1 appointments that are for asylum right now into CBP-1 appointments for potential positions in the U.S. where people are looking for U.S. workers, we could really make this work for people outside the U.S. who want to come into the U.S. looking for work.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And we see this in real time. The Biden administration in January of 2023 created this humanitarian parole program for Cubans, Haitians, Nicaraguans, and Venezuelans for 30,000 total a month to come in, to find a U.S. sponsor for them to come in temporarily to be allowed to work. And what we saw immediately was a large decline and apprehensions of those people coming, people from those countries coming to the border illegally to try to ask for asylum or to try to just enter. And so that's just a great example of how you could channel these folks into a legal market. You can do a little bit better vetting, and by letting them in lawfully, you take some of the pressure off of border security. And, you know, it's just important to emphasize, these folks are coming here because Americans and our economic decisions every day want them to be here. Americans want to employ them. We want to rent apartments to them. We want to buy and sell and trade goods and services with them. And, you know, sometimes some of us fall in love with them and want to marry them, right? So it's
I sense a personal
story. Oh, all that.
Well, I'm using the royal us.
royal we.
So they're coming because we want them, you know? And it's easy to go into a voting booth once every 2 to 4 years and say, nah, I don't want them, click. But then, click for that candidate who doesn't want them. But in every economic decision we make, we are voting with our dollars every day, multiple times a day, to interact with these individuals.
But in many ways, Alex, also we hear stories about, people believing that immigrants and refugees take jobs. They're competing with us for certain positions. They are challenging the economic order. And that is an issue that I think you also address very effectively in your report.
Yes. So the evidence for that is basically zero. So the way to think about it is immigrants are workers. That's true. They increase the supply of labor. And if you stopped there, you'd probably think they lower wages. But of course, immigrants are also people. They buy things. And they increase demand. So it's not just like when people say, oh, immigrants lower wages, it's supply and demand. They only talk about supply. There's also demand. And immigrants, they buy things, they create. And by buying things, there's more demand for jobs in the United States. Immigrants are also twice as likely to start a business as native-born Americans are, which is, creates at least one job for the immigrant himself or herself. You also find that the places in the country where population is growing are the places where jobs are growing. And it's, it cuts both ways, right? People move to places that are doing well. And then while they're there, they improve the economy even more. You see this with the Haitians going to Springfield. Nobody put them there. They are attracted to that place because of local jobs, economic opportunity, and a relatively lower cost of living. So it's just this idea that immigrants take jobs, that they force Americans out of the labor market, that they have a big effect on wages, is just it's what economists call lump of labor fallacy. There is no fixed pie. There is no fixed number of jobs. We have a relatively free market economy, and we create them, and more people are an economic positive.
I was going to say, and just to add on that, there's a system in our immigration procedure that can test the labor market. So before even someone can get a green card, we test the labor market to see if there's any available U.S. workers. So our immigration regulations, the way they are thought out, they think about this. And if the H-1B visa worker wants to come over, the Department of Labor ensures that they're being paid a fair wage and something that's comparable to our U.S. workers are being paid. So it's still competitive. I mean, there's different things in our laws that help to protect that whole concept of whether someone's bringing someone for a U.S. worker to work for a lower price or whether someone's going to replace a U.S. worker in the labor market. It's when we don't have these laws in place and we don't bring them over properly that the foreign nationals are subjected to working in conditions that are for a lower wage or in poor conditions because no one's regulating that because they feel like there's no other way to bring them over to work legally here in the U.S.
I'm curious in the Bob, is there anything you wanted to add? Okay. I'm curious when you look at this, your common myths about immigration, and one is immigrants pose a unique risk today because of terrorism. And I'm also that immigrants are a major source of crime. Why do those two particular myths stick so really to the point of allowing us often to have these conversations, because it's often the first place people go to when they think of it as a quote-unquote problem.
So I think for terrorism specifically, terrorism is a very dramatic crime. It's intended to be by the terrorists themselves, right? They want to make usually a political or religious or other kind of larger social point. They're ideologically motivated. They want to scare the heck out of everybody else in order to try to bring about change. And so their attacks and their crimes are dramatic and brutal. So we pay a lot of attention to them. And there have been foreign-born terrorists, of course, on U.S. soil. You know, the 9/11 hijackers were all foreign-born. They weren't immigrants, but they were 18 of them were on a tourist visa. One was on a student visa. And there have been others in American history. But it's also important to note that terrorism is very rare. It's an unusual crime. From 1975 to the, you know, so far in this year, there have been 3,046 people murdered in terrorist attacks on U.S. soil committed by foreign-born terrorists. And that translates to about a 1 in 4.5 million chance per year of being murdered in those attacks. It accounts for far less than 1% of all homicides during that time. And since 9/11, it's accounted for about 0.01% of all homicides. I mean, your chance of being murdered in a homicide in the U.S., just a normal homicide, is during that entire 50-year period, about 323 times higher. So it's dramatic, it's brutal, and because of that, we pay attention to it. And then on crime, I think there's a real sense, a lot of people sort of have this reaction that it's just more newsworthy when a crime is committed by an outsider, by somebody outside of your community, and especially when they're from outside of the United States. But the evidence is that illegal immigrants are less likely to be criminals than native-born Americans, and legal immigrants are the least crime-prone of all. And we have great data from the state of Texas about that, which counts all of its convictions and arrests by immigration status. So, you know, there are definitely some bad individuals in any large group. There are about 47, 48 million immigrants total in the United States. There are going to be some criminals there. But I think we should focus on criminal law enforcement to try to punish them. If they become convicted of if they are convicted and commit a crime, I think they should be removed from the United States. But it's also, if you want to cut crime by deporting all illegal immigrants in the U.S., you're not going to cut the crime rate because it's a less crime-prone population. That is not a good use of resources if your goal is to save American lives.
That was Alex Norasta on the Roundtable panel on Wednesday, September 18th. We'll be back with more after this break. Welcome back to the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. On Thursday, September 19th, Alive at the Linda panel focused on diversity, equity, and inclusion, DEI. Joe was joined by President CEO of the McLean Collective with areas of focus, equity, team building, and leadership, Kathleen McLean, Director of Diversity, Equity, Inclusion, and Belonging at Together for Youth, Jay Hawley, Vice President for Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion College Diversity Officer at Bennington College, Alfredo Medina Jr., Executive Director of the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York, Nick Rangel, and Vice President for Editorial Development at the New York Press Association, Judy Patrick.
We were talking to Nick about why it is so complicated to have these conversations. And one of the things that Nick brought up was, you know, just as an example of seeing the vitriol that you see just on social media when we posted that we were going to have this discussion. And it's interesting and alarming, actually, to read some of the comments. I want to hear from the rest of the panel, but then I also then want to talk a little bit about social media and how that plays into a lot of this. Alfredo, as far as you, especially on campuses, having these conversations, do you believe it needs to be as complicated as it is?
I don't know if complicated is the word that I would consider this to be. I believe it's more nuanced. And part of that is because there's certain things about my own experiences that I don't feel are as complex as people want to believe it is. I think they want to believe that because it makes it much more difficult to shake their own beliefs that they've been taught all their lives. So they run to say, well, it's complex. And what I say is, well, no, I think it's just that it's more nuanced, right? Because at times I find that the work that I do and the work that we all do here is that it's always having to challenge what has always been historical of the United States, and that is the black and white binary. Everything in this country is always within the context of the civil rights. And post-civil rights, we've seen a wave of immigration in this country. We've seen where we've made progress. And yet we continue to still see everything as if everything were happening 60 years ago. And there's still truth to that there's a lot that hasn't changed, as I like to say, to the work that Michelle Alexander does, right? There's the new Jim Crow. And a lot of that is that instead of having enslavement in this country, we see mass incarceration of particularly black and brown men, including women would arise in that, or taking away rights because you're a convicted felon, or having to check the box that is going to keep you from experiencing social mobility. But a lot of that is nuanced because a lot of it is dependent on where a person comes from, what were their situations, what are the circumstances, how not to treat everyone as a monolith. And so when I have these conversations on our campus with faculty, staff, and students, the first thing I always say to myself is, I need to meet you where you are. I am not going to ever come into this conversation and make assumptions about you, right? Regardless of how you look, regardless of your lived experience. Because deep in there, I'm going to realize that you probably have your own traumatic experiences. There are things that you probably are carrying from ideas that were brought onto you by your parents and maybe others. And I'd like to give you some grace, unless you want to be blatantly racist, and then I'm not going to give you any grace. But I try to meet people where they are. And what I do find challenging, though, in this work that we do here, even on college campuses, is that everything is black and white. There's no grayness. So I want to be very careful about when we use the word complex, it gives sometimes people an excuse to want to delve into the deep conversations we need to have because they're far more nuanced than they are complex. And they can be both. But in the end, what I'd like to do is to be able to contextualize everything that we do around DEI as opposed to just wanting to attack it based on what people believe it means to them.
Jay.
Thank you so much, Alfredo, because I think that nuance really speaks to needing to develop skills around having these conversations. I think one of the challenges, I think it's less a matter of complexity and more a matter of comfort, that we have been socialized to not talk about certain things, right? We don't talk about religion, we don't talk about politics in quote unquote polite company. And so because this is viewed as a complex issue, it's something we don't talk about because it makes people feel uncomfortable. Heaven forbid we make anyone feel uncomfortable. There is a need to build skills around how to have conversations about the nuance, about the complexity, about the lived experience, and to create spaces in which we can bring those skills to bear, right? To create opportunities to bring people with different kind of lived experience together to hear from one another. So I think the opportunity to build skills is why this work around DEI is so important, because it continues to call us into conversation about things that make us uncomfortable, but that are essential in our business practices. We know that businesses that deeply embed practices of DEI are more successful in all the ways we measure business success, but only if it is a complete picture, right? So it's not just enough to bring in people with different skin color, but we actually have to talk about that lived experience that those people bring, those perspectives that people bring into the workplace. And for those of us who work in businesses or organizations that serve humans, right, understanding the complexity that walks in the door when a child or a family is coming in for services, that we have to take into account that lived experience so that we can provide the best level of service, so that we can address the trauma that they have experienced in ways that promote healing and recovery. And so the idea of the skills needed to talk about this is something that I think has gotten lost in the vitriol, in the name calling and finger pointing in social media.
Kathleen.
What you made me think of is a saying I say often: we do not play together, pray together, or live together.
Yes.
Therefore, we don't know each other. And Jane Elliott is probably 85 now. She's an anti-racist. She started this work when Dr. Martin Luther King was assassinated, and she had a third grade class, and she did the blue eye, brown eye study. And we know the IRB today, she could never do that, right? Dr. Medina, that would never happen today. And what she says is that we have all been indoctrinated and not educated.
Yes.
And therefore, there is that, when I thought of the thing you said about socialization, and that's what Jane Elliott talks about. And when I think about skills, one of the things we do in my firm is we did this with educators, right? We've done it with many groups, so we did this particularly with educators. And we use this text, actually, Why Are All the Black Children Sitting Together in the Cafeteria? And every single week, participants would read a chapter of the book. Then they would come in, and we'd have a conversation for 2 hours about the book. The first 3 to 4 weeks, when you talk about fear, everyone was fearful, because they didn't want to say the wrong thing or do the wrong thing or think the wrong thing. But as people began to have those conversations about racial identity, about privilege, about white fragility, about all the things that are connected to that social identity, politics, and, you know, enslavement, homophobia, people began to get more comfortable, because everyone, that was my role, to give people the words. And there were times where I would say, ouch, right? And so that we would pause and we would say, that is not something you can say. That hurts people. And someone would come to the room and say, that offended me, that hurt me. But they have those conversations, and it's only through conversation we're going to heal. Right? Why do we go to therapy? Because we talk, right? My background, I have a bachelor's and master's in social work. We talk so that we can heal. If we don't talk, we are never going to heal. So we must talk.
Judy.
So this is a wonderful platform to have those kinds of conversations, but social media is where most of the conversations are happening, and it's an ugly place. The discussion about the WAMC DEI form is a classic example. What comes out is, again, demonization of the term. I almost hesitate to, I would almost advise people not to use the term, to talk about it in a more general way in order to facilitate the conversation, because right now, I would say 90% of the people in my feed are just blatantly racist. They're scared. There are so many myths out there about DEI, and it's one of the media's responsibilities to try to dispel those myths, to correct those myths, to approach them head on and explain what's wrong. But on social media nowadays, the facts seem to not matter so often, and logical reasoning doesn't seem to matter. But I think you have to keep trying and not give up. And many times on Facebook, you're inclined to not go there.
I was just looking, we'll take this as an example, and it is just but one example, and
perhaps not the best example. But early on, when after Joe Biden left the race and Kamala Harris started to ascend, and it was apparent that she was going to be the Democratic candidate, is when many, including Tennessee Congressman Timothy Burchett, who is exactly the same age as Kamala Harris, we should say, and has somewhat of a thinner resume, claims that because she is a woman of color chosen for such a high office, she is just another example of the kind of mediocrity that you get when you make a DEI hire. Kathleen, I will go to you first. I know this is a lot of the work that you do, and I mean, what do you do with that? Well, I mean, I know what I want to do with it, yeah. But what do you do with it that's constructive?
Well, I mean, I think we all heard it. It reverberated all over the land, especially with women that look like me. We are used to hearing those kinds of things. And how we deal with it is we just do our action and do the work and show up in our excellence. Because our work and our excellence is what's going to combat the lies and the vitriol. That has been thrown our way. And so many times we just ignore it because if we had to fight every voice that said we are less than, we don't deserve to be in that space, we would be in a combative state all the time. And personally for me, I choose not to be in that place because it's harmful, hurtful, and it can be very painful. I mean, I know with Kamala Harris, I know when they questioned her identity, she made one statement and did not respond to it. I'm not sure if she responded to that DEI hire comment that was made. I'm not sure if she did make any statement about that. Though I think the thing is to, one, show action and do the work. Number two, can ignore it. And that's what he wanted. He wanted to just make this inflammatory statement. Everybody, really, most people know that is not true, that she is not a DEI. I mean, she went to law school. She has all the credentials. And you're correct, I think, with what you had said, you know, about the lies that people perpetuate in our society about people that look like me. And therefore, we combat it with our action, our excellence, and at times when we engage in a conversation, we can do that. But sometimes people don't want to listen or hear. And sometimes it's better to be silent because then it causes more angst and fighting with someone. And some people, they're not going to change their mind. And so sometimes you have to pause, step away, and let them believe their nonsense and their lies.
Okay. And so I really love that you're calling into the conversation standing in excellence, right? That the idea of rising above the vitriol, rising above the mudslinging. And there's also a cost to that. So in her book, Weathering, Dr. Arlene Geronimus talks about the impact of living in a society where systemic and institutionalized racism is so prevalent, and that it physically takes a toll on bodies of color, right? It changes DNA, it changes our body's ability to respond to stress. It physically is impacting people of color. And so we see all sorts of side effects of that, of women of color being far more likely to die in childbirth than their white counterparts. We see high-achieving black professionals having shortened lifespans compared to their white counterparts. It's physically taking a toll. So while rising to excellence is an amazing answer, there's a cost to that. There's a cost to being in a society where that is not just allowed, but is the norm, right? So what the congressman did was not unexpected, right? Nobody thought, well, gosh, I wonder what lovely things he's going to say about Kamala. There's an expectation that as someone who stands in Black excellence, that you will be the target of attack. And because of that, there's a physical price that is paid. So we talk about trauma, we're talking about the impact that it has on the body and the spirit. And so I think it's important that we continue to push back against the normalization of those kinds of comments and the vitriol that we've seen.
When you talked about health, I was listening to a podcast and it was talking about Black people who come from the Caribbean, African culture, and then when they come here, what happens is they, in terms of looking at white bodies and Black bodies, their health outcomes are the same for white people. Until they live in America, their health deteriorates. But they have the same health outcomes before they get here. The minute they get here, how it changes. So when you talk about health, that is a very, you know, it's documented.
Yeah.
So thank you for bringing that in the conversation.
I want to make 2 points. Is it was not only Republican lawmakers and electeds who diminished the qualifications of Kamala Harris to be the presidential ticket. And we were on shows to the lead up as people were calling for Joe Biden to step down. There were a lot of debates and discussions about who should replace him. And I was on the roundtable saying, obviously, Kamala Harris, she is the most qualified person. She's literally the vice president right now. And there was not a lot of support for that until Joe Biden endorsed her when he stepped off the ticket. So it is true that the conservative congressman made these comments publicly, but Democrats were making those comments privately. And I do want to remind people that the pushback on diversity hires is broad. It crosses social economic populations. It crosses political lines. It is actually a very common refrain in pretty much every group of people. Actually, most people oppose the concept of affirmative action in the United States. So this is not a Republican-Democrat problem. This is a problem in America. This is an American problem. And I want to just step back and remind people that whiteness is a social and political construct. And so many of these conversations forget that there was a whitening of other communities who were initially, when they arrived in the Americas, were not considered white. Irish, the other half of my family line, was not considered white either, right? They just got to become white politically before my Hispanic identity has, right? So I think that's important to remember here in politics, that we have to be aware every day and diligent every day in every space. And I don't give anybody any extra leeway there. The other thing that happens with this particular commentary is that this congressman has to diminish and be dismissive of every single decision made on behalf or in relation to Kamala Harris in her resume, right? That means he is saying that she got into college on race and gender. She got into law school on race and gender. She somehow passed the bar exam on race and gender. She got hired as a prosecutor and then elected by the people of California on race and gender. What did he do? I mean, like, what does that mean, right? And every step of the way, I'm very involved in party politics. Party politics are very, very complicated. There are a lot of, I'd say, interest groups and stakeholder groups. There is not a universal or homogenous point of view in any of these parties. And the fact that she has climbed in her resume and climbed this ladder, we have to highlight how dismissive and ignorant it is to assume that she became the presidential candidate because she's a woman of color. The absurdity is beyond is beyond me.
That was Nick Rangel on the Roundtable panel on Thursday, September 19th. We'll be back with more of the Roundtable panel The Week in Review after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. On Friday, September 20th, a locked box panel focused on Trump's finances. Joe was joined by Executive Director of the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York, Nick Rangel, public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois, Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times American investigative journalist Russ Buettner, and Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times Canadian investigative journalist Suzanne Craig.
As you listen to this, Teresa, what would you like to ask Suzanne and Russ?
So it seems that your book lays out a pretty consistent pattern of Trump's disregard for the rules, disregard for who and what he leaves in his wake. And for me, the question of the moment is, for those who will be voting over the next 7 weeks, particularly those who are undecided, what does this foreshadow for what he will do if reelected? You know, how he will run the government's economy, given how he's, you know, run his own businesses. And in particular, you ended by talking about the IRS. And as you know, the Biden-Harris administration has worked to try to strengthen the ability of the IRS to ensure that high earners pay the taxes that are due. But given how Trump's father and then Trump worked to really circumvent the rules of the IRS throughout their careers, what do you think the possibility is that if elected president again, he will work in that regard at all? Or, you know, what does this foreshadow for keeping the rules or trying to make those high earners pay their fair share?
They're excellent questions, Teresa. I think one of the trends that you'll see in how Donald Trump ran businesses was also exhibited in his first term as president. And that's that he doesn't really worry about making revenue and expenses match. He never has his whole life. In business, he had this idea that if his name was on it, it would make enough money to match whatever he spent on it. And his life was really an object lesson in proving that thesis wrong. But he ran the government in basically the same way, right? He cut revenue tremendously by giving tax breaks to big corporations and high earners. That had a huge impact on the sort of public fisc. And it led to some of the biggest deficits, I think actually the biggest deficits ever, and the biggest deficits even in relation to GDP. I think you can expect more of that. And your question about the IRS is an excellent thing to point out. He has been, in looking at this kind of epic saga of his father's life and his life, they've been at war with the IRS for their entire lives. He right now is actively at war with the IRS. We had a story a couple of months ago about how he secretly had declared one of his last piece of new construction, the tower he built in Chicago, he had declared that project to be completely worthless. And in doing so, he was trying to take a second write-off on money he had already written off as a loss. And there's an ongoing audit related to that that could easily cost him more than $100 million if the IRS continues to pursue it and the IRS prevails. So I think you can see in that he has no interest in boosting the IRS's enforcement capabilities. It's a talking point of the entire MAGA movement and the Republican Party to a degree that the IRS is bad, that everything the IRS does is overreach and it should not be funded up to do more. And this area of his life, partnership taxation, is one I've spoken to former IRS people who say the IRS doesn't really know how to do that. And Donald Trump has 500 partnerships and filed some years 500 returns for those partnerships.
And if you don't look at them all, each individually and each one and also in total, you cannot get a good picture of what's happening there. And he's not entirely unique there. So if they don't increase that, and Donald Trump has no interest in doing it, that's a big portion of the tax code that just goes unenforced. So I think, in short, what you can see is he's not going to run the government in a way that's going to help balance the budget. That in itself is inflationary. It's not good for the overall economy. And he's not going to at all increase the audit enforcement capabilities of the IRS in a way that could bring in more money and clamp down on some of the things that he's partaken in for much of his life.
I want to get to Nick Rangel, but just a follow-up to Teresa's excellent question and what you were just saying about he's not going to. But well, what did we learn about what he's going to do from his first term, his first 4 years in office? Go ahead.
You mean about enforcement? Is that what you mean?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's sort of what I tried to say before, that there were calls to increase enforcement, and I think actually they reduced enforcement during that period of time. And the percentage of INR taxpayers that were audited was flat or went down. And he's made comments since then that sort of he's been treated unfairly by the IRS for his entire life. And that the audit I mentioned is a part of that. And I think it's safe to assume he's going to act on that overall philosophy.
And that has a price for working.
Go ahead.
Well, that's exactly what I was going to say, Teresa, is I think then what happens is because the IRS doesn't enforce the tax code against wealthy Americans as I think it should, it falls to W-2 employees, and that's usually where actually audits happen in America. It's sort of a shocking thing, but really maybe not, because that's where you're going to get some, at least if you get an enforcement, you're going to get some money there from somebody who's got a W-2 and they're actually making money. Part of what's unsatisfying about going after people like Donald Trump is they have huge losses. So even if you get a win, you don't necessarily get money for the U.S. Treasury. But it's as we go forward, if they're not going to fund the IRS so that we can actually enforce the tax code, which I actually think if that's something that this country did, it would solve a lot of problems in this country. It's going to continue just to put pressure on kind of the middle America and people who are W-2 salaried employees in this country.
I want to go to Nick Rangel.
Thank you. This is so interesting. And I keep jotting down notes, and then Joe asks the question that I had queued up. But I was just reading a little more background on sort of how Trump has created this narrative about his wealth. And there was an article in the 70s that he claimed he was worth like $200 million. Yeah. And then in 2018, the New York Times found that he was worth about $400 million, or at least had inherited and received about $400 million in family wealth. Where do you folks put like the value of what he received from his dad over the years at this stage?
Probably around, I mean, it's, what do you, we adjust it for inflation, but what do you think, Russ? Probably $400 or $500 million. Is that about right?
Yeah, in 2018, you said about 413, and certainly by now that would be probably over five. Yeah.
Okay, over $500 million. But you look at, though, that article that you mentioned is really interesting from the early 1970s, because when he told the New York Times that he was worth $200 million, in fact, he was appropriating his father's wealth at that point. He was a young kid who, you know, was filing tax returns where he barely had any income. But he very early on started to appropriate his father's wealth and say it was his own. And that was how he was able to get on, you know, the lists of the wealthiest people in the country. And because the Trump Organization was privately held. Yeah. And then he sort of fell into this incredible sort of moment in America where he befriended a lot of journalists. You know, Larry King is one that comes to mind. There were others, but he befriended these people and was able to get on TV, and they would call him a billionaire. 60 Minutes even did a program without any evidence and, you know, said, you know, Trump the billionaire on it. And that just sort of started to become repeated over and over and became fact without any evidence provided by Donald Trump that he was. He was just appropriating his father's wealth in articles over and over, and then he became a billionaire. And at that point, you know, we didn't, hindsight's great here. We didn't know at the time, you know, where we would be today. And he was more sort of a celebrity or a character in New York. So did it matter? You know, Russ and I, all that stuff matters to us as journalists, but for a certain segment of the media, this tabloid culture, this wealth porn, you know, shows like Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous, you know, I just don't know how much people were really, you know, taking it that seriously. But it happened, and it has consequences now.
Let me ask you, go ahead, Nick. I'm sorry.
Oh, yeah. I was also, you know, Teresa kind of mentioned that the IRS, and you've discussed how the IRS is not really poised to be in a position to, you know, go after potential bad actors. But I'm more interested in the sort of anti-government mindset here, where not only were they, is the Trump family just like kind of fundamentally opposed to the notion of paying taxes, but also the language that he uses around our government institutions really has had the effect of diminishing trust in these public institutions. And I'm wondering, you know, from your perspective, kind of where does that really stem from? Is it purely fiscal and financial, or is there some like greater philosophy that's sort of anti-government and anti-federal government?
Yeah, that's an excellent question, Nick. I think that is one of the currents that runs through our book is how much Donald Trump has never really changed or evolved much over the years. But one thing that you might notice is he hadn't really voiced those sort of things before, a strong anti-government overall policy that all these agencies should be closed down and whatnot. But I think where it comes from is since he was a young man in the 70s, he's believed that he was persecuted, that he was being treated unfairly because he was Trump. People wanted to take him down. People were out to get him. There's a zoning board hearing he's sitting in for Trump Tower in the late 70s, and he's saying, you know, I could build a park on Park Avenue, and people would still oppose me just because I'm Trump. And he actually got that approved. But in his mind, because there was a hearing, he was being persecuted. And that comes up just over and over through the years. Yeah. Everything that happens to him, he doesn't believe he made a mistake. He believes somebody else was unfairly out to get him with impure motives. And you certainly saw that just overtake him during the White House. I think what you're talking about has become a Republican talking point. All of federal government is bad. I think in his case, it just stems from the notion that everything that happened to him in the White House was because other people, bad actors, were out to get him. And this notion of the deep state has really infected his brain. But that to me is where I think it comes from, is this lifelong persecution complex.
Do you see the issues of race also having a through line through, I know, it, in the early approach to his for his father and housing him the same? Do you see the same through line with issues of race?
We just have about 2 minutes. Suzanne?
Yeah, I mean, I think that case in the early 1970s is, you know, a big example. I mean, I'm trying to think of other ones in the book. I think that one is the main one. Am I right on that, Russ? I don't think we see it come up again. We see other sort of patterns, and especially the victimhood that Russ talked about.
And how he treats his workers in general also.
Right? Well, and that's a really big one is, you know, again and again, and you see it in the book. People are getting shortchanged by him, and it became just a pattern. It was a way of doing business where they, you know, the Trump organization would factor in that there was just going to be a discount when somebody came with a bill that needed to be paid, that he wasn't going to pay the whole bill. And a lot of people, you know, talk about it and just how they were threatened. You know, they realized that if they wanted to get their money out of them, sometimes they got pennies on the dollar, that they would have to go into litigation with them. And a lot of these are small business people, and they just didn't think it was worth the cost because it would almost cost more to litigate with him than, you know, so they just said, forget it. And that's how he was able to get away with shortchanging so many people. But it was one of the ways that he did business. It wasn't just it happened here and there. It happened over and over and over again.
A couple things I just want to get to before as we wrap up. And again, our great thanks to you for being with us and for sharing your expertise and for sharing the story and your incredible work with our audience. It's so important that we hear these stories. My question is, as I mentioned, you have the accounting, you have the economic, but then you also have the psychological. There's been so much about the speculation, I would say, that here is a kid, Donald Trump, who basically was trying to impress his father and doing so in vain. But you paint a picture of a father who really never wavered and was always there to support Donald Trump, right, Russ?
That's absolutely correct. I think that was one of the things that startled us most, because a lot of what we had heard was that Fred Trump was this really rough taskmaster and he must have really scarred Donald with all his demands. But they're so different, and you never see a time when Fred seems to scold Donald for being so different. It's like I mentioned before that Fred's projects all ran perfectly in aligning costs and revenue. And Donald Trump, that was a problem with him from the start. Fred Trump never announced a project until he was ready to sell it and had everything lined up. Donald Trump was announcing, when he joined his father's company, he began right away announcing projects that weren't projects yet. He would say they owned land and they were going to build a shopping mall, but they didn't own the land. He would say they were going to build a convention center in Washington, D.C., and he hadn't done anything in that regard. And that was very counter to Fred Trump, but it was part of Donald Trump creating the impression that he was everywhere, and Fred went along for the ride. And when Donald's projects began to collapse and have problems because of Donald's design of the business and operation of the businesses, there was never a time when Fred said, you know, you've got to change your ways on this. He would just give him more support. But I think the big one, and we probably touched on this already, is that Donald Trump, as part of his effort to make himself look huge, made his father look smaller than he actually was. He would say, and he still says it to this day, you heard it in the debate last week, that my father did Brooklyn and Queens. And sometimes he'll say, my father was small time. His father was not small time. His father was a billionaire of his era in today's numbers. But that was part of his Donald making himself look more heroic. And his father went along with that also, even saying, yes, he's surpassed me. He's bigger than me. Everything he touches turns to gold. And that was when Donald had completed about 1.5 buildings. So it's really a remarkable relationship of support. And in some ways, we think it's kind of set Donald's expectations with other people, which is that he does not want to be challenged. He wants to be support. That's the bubble in which he grew up in and the one he still wants to live in today.
That was Russ Buettner on the Roundtable panel on Friday, September 20th. Full episodes of the Roundtable panel are available online at wamc.org/roundtable. On Tuesday, September 24th, David Daley and other guests will be on a Locked Box Roundtable panel special focused on voting rights in our country. This will be live on air from 9 to 11 a.m. on Tuesday. And on Wednesday, September 25th, Aaron Pasitti and Pavlina Chernova will be on a Locked Box Roundtable panel special with other guests focused on economics. This will be live on air from 9 to 11 a.m. on Wednesday. The WAMC Locked Box is open, and anything you can give now helps shorten our on-air fund drive. You may pledge anytime at WAMC.org. This has been this week's Roundtable Panel The Week in Review. I'm Madeline Reynolds. Thank you for listening.